Good morning, everyone. I know everybody is fulfilled in one sense and tired in another sense, anticipating our return back to our respective places. Before I begin, I just need to make an editorial correction. Our reference here, 1 Corinthians 11:26, that ought to be 2 Corinthians 11:26. So if you happen to look that up and it didn't make any sense, that should be 2 Corinthians 11:26, where the Apostle Paul speaks of being in perils by false brethren. Okay. So today we will begin part two of our look at the parable of Naboth's vineyard. And we're going to go into a little bit more depth concerning the native country of Jezebel and look at the type there and some related, or I would say adjacent things to consider in relation to what Jezebel and Sidon, or Zidon if you prefer, represent. And we'll begin with the Sidonians. And Sidon or Sidonian means, obviously, an inhabitant of Sidon. It comes from the Hebrew word T-S-U-W-D, meaning to lie in wait. By implication, to catch an animal, figuratively men, to chase or hunt in the sense of catching fish, fishery, the son of Canaan, a place in Palestine. Sidon was the son of Canaan. That's in Genesis 10, if you go back to the Table of Nations, whose descendants settled along the coastal plain of Palestine approximately 500 years before Abraham came into the land, so circa 2500 B.C. The city of Sidon, in a loose alliance with other city-states, bounded on the west by the Mediterranean, the east by the mountains of Lebanon, the south by Mount Carmel, and the north by Arvad and Aradus. That's in it. Ezekiel 27, formed a territory known by the ancients as Phoenicia. The Sidonians, like their Canaanite neighbors, were polytheistic worshippers of sun, moon, and stars. Chief among these gods and goddesses of Sidon was Ashtoreth, or Astarte. Also, Asherah is one of the Jewish terms. Titled the Queen of Heaven, of Babylonish origin, whose worship included immoral practices as part of the sacred rites of religion. The danger that they presented to Israel lies in contrast with the relative distance from the center of tribal inheritance. And if you'll note from the map, here is Asher, who has perhaps the most northern allotment, and then here is Tyre and then Sidon. So if you think about, you know, where the center of Israel was, they were relatively far removed. But this underscores the fact that even when danger seems afar off, it can do great harm if left unchecked. The prophet Samuel describes the Sidonians as dwelling carelessly. And let's look at Judges 18, verse 7. Judges 18, verse 7. Then the five men departed and came to Laish, and saw that the people that were therein, how they dwelt careless, after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, and there was no magistrate in the land that might put them to shame in anything, and they were far from the Sidonians and had no business with any, or with any man. Well, several points might be derived from these facts, including the meaning of the name Sidonian. The name appears to have been arranged providentially, showing forth the future of Israel, having been caught or snared by the gods of this idolatrous people. Let's look at Proverbs 6:26. Proverbs 6:26. For by means of a whorish woman, a man is brought to a piece of bread, and the adulteress will hunt for the precious life. So that word there, hunt, is the Hebrew Sidon, or T-S-U-W-D, Sidon. It's the same word. In Jeremiah, we find a similar use of the term thusly. Behold, I will send for many fishers, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And after will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt, again Hebrew Sidon, hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. Although there's certainly more than one application of these passages, we find a striking resemblance in them with the manner in which Israel was ensnared and deceived, beginning with Solomon seeking after strange women, 1 Kings 11, and climaxing with the marriage of King Ahab to Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, high priest of Astarte. The reader will recall that it was Jezebel who hunted down and stoned the prophets. And let's look at 1 Kings 18. Beginning at verse 4. For it was so, when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord, that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. And Ahab said unto Obadiah, go into the land and to all fountains of water and unto all brooks. Preadventure we may find grass to save the horses and mules alive, that we lose not all the beasts. So they divided the land between them to pass through it. Ahab went one way by himself, and Obadiah went another way by himself. And as Obadiah was in the way, behold, Elijah met him, and he knew him and fell on his face and said, art thou that, my lord Elijah? And he answered him, I am. Go and tell thy lord, behold, Elijah is here. And he said, what, have I sinned, that thou wouldest deliver thy servant into the hand of Ahab to slay me? As the Lord thy God liveth, there is no nation or kingdom whither my Lord hath not sent to seek thee. And when they said, he is not there, he took an oath of the kingdom and nation that they found thee not. And now thou sayest, go and tell thy Lord, behold, Elijah is here. And it shall come to pass, as soon as I am gone from thee, that the Spirit of the Lord shall carry thee whither I know not. And so when I come and tell Ahab, and cannot find thee, he shall slay me. But I, thy servant, fear the Lord from my youth. Was it not told my Lord what I did when Jezebel slew the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water? The Lord Yahweh will ever be a refuge to hide his servants from the wicked and so preserve them and his message down through the ages. Yet those who lack faith, becoming the children of disobedience, are ever prone to the deceivableness of unrighteousness in them that perish, because they receive not the love of the truth, that they might be saved. And for this cause shall God send them strong delusion, that they should believe a lie, that they all might be damned who believe not the truth, but had pleasure, as Ahab, in unrighteousness. 2 Thessalonians 2, 10, and 11. Of this sort again was Ahab, who was enticed by Jezebel and caused all Israel to go a-whoring after her gods, for whom she set up the high places of worship. By being caught or ensnared by the gods of the Sidonians, both Solomon and Ahab brought ruin upon Israel. As such, Jezebel is a name and representation of a people or system that would forever live in infamy among the prophets of Israel. And we have not time to turn, but you might note Isaiah 23, and we may refer back to that later. Jeremiah 47, Ezekiel 28, Joel 3, and Zechariah 9 are all very condemning of Zidon. Jezebel is representative of all that sin can do. to snatch away the precious gift of eternal life and render death and destruction in its place. Let's look at Revelation 2, verse 20. Notwithstanding, I have a few things against thee, because thou sufferest that woman Jezebel, which calleth herself a prophetess, to teach and to seduce my servants to commit fornication and to eat things sacrificed unto idols. And I gave her space to repent of her fornication, and she repented not. Behold, I will cast her into a bed, and them that commit adultery with her into great tribulation, except they repent of their deeds. And I will kill their children with death, and all the ecclesias shall know that I am he which searcheth the reins and hearts, and I will give unto every one of you according to your works. So we see here, Jezebel then becomes a fit representative of the apostasy, corporately manifested first in the ecclesia of the first century, and then in the kingdoms of men, as later revealed in the apocalypse. Now we're going to look a little bit more at the antitype. Let's look at Revelation 12. Revelation 12:1, and there appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she being with child cried, travailing in birth, and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew the third part of stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all nations with the rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And file that in your mind for a moment, and let's also look at Revelation 17, verse 1. And there came one of the 7 angels, which had the 7 vials, and talked with me, saying unto me, Come hither, I will show unto thee the judgment of the great whore that sitteth upon many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. So he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sit upon a scarlet-colored beast, full of names of blasphemy, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet, and decked with gold and precious stones and pearls, having a golden cup in her hand full of abominations and filthiness of her fornication. And upon her forehead was a name written, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth. So we noted earlier that the Sidonians were polytheistic worshippers of the heavenlies. Chief among them was Astarte or Ashtaroth or whichever you prefer, the Queen of Heaven. The antitype of this arrangement, as we read in chapter 12, began its career as an unchaste woman, crowned with a wreath of 12 stars, having the moon at her feet. This was a representation given to the Apostle John of the ecclesia that had become impregnated or apostate with a mix of superstitious idolatry and Jewish tradition. And we would note, not unlike Israel of old. At length such that a remnant of true believers and political antagonists could be separated from the mainstream of pseudo-brethren and thus preserved, the woman or apostate ecclesia gave birth to the man-child Constantine the Great, who universalized the Catholic apostasy in its present form of veiled idolatry, painted up like a Jezebel to woo the nations with her golden cup of iniquity. Note that the polytheistic worship of so-called saints in the heavens by the Catholic religion is a remarkable parallel with the pagan religion of the ancients. Thus, she even now dwells carelessly beneath the star-enshrined insignia of the modern Sidonian merchants, the European Union, declaring, "I sit a queen and am no widow," and all the while feigning herself to be the Mother Church, a careless boast by a system whose blood will no less assuredly be cast to the dogs as wicked Jezebel's. For they have shed the blood of saints and prophets, and thou hast given them blood to drink, for they are worthy. Their self-identification with Revelation chapter 12 is remarkable. Roman Catholics believe that John, in the 12th chapter, was seeing a vision of Mary, the chaste virgin. We are aware, however, that this is no chaste virgin. And we note on the overhead, perhaps a familiar magazine cover, showing the woman, Europa, riding the beast, Zeus, with the Stephanos, or crown of 12 stars, over her head. And as some of the literature that Uncle Richard handed out, this is most definitely a Catholic symbol. In fact, the artist that put this together, and I wasn't aware of this until I read it for myself, back in the 50s, when this flag was brought to fruition, the artist himself, when asked what was his inspiration, very frankly says, well, the images of the Immaculate Conception, which are all over Europe. They're on the cathedrals, on the top, the Mary with the Stephanos of 12 stars, the window of Europe, as it's called in the cathedral at Strasbourg, also Mary with the 12 stars. So a very Catholic symbol. And as has already been noted, it's on their coins, their currency, their banknotes, you name it, even their license plates has this symbol. Well, ancient Israel was to be proved by a deceptive people of this sort. Likewise, the present day ecclesia is tested by a society that is rampant with superstition, immorality, and idolatry. But again, we reiterate that there is another warning. As Ahab, meaning brother, had taken Jezebel to wife. The symbol is a striking example and warning against fellowship of the ecclesia with the world and its false creeds. Those that take into their bosom the false doctrines and teachings of the seed of the serpent are complicit in the sins of the apostasy and will reap condemnation to the eternal grave. And as we went through yesterday, there's an internal aspect of that as well in the ecclesia. I hope we're all clear on Sidon and Jezebel as they are fit types of the system of man that we're dealing with today, a system of deceit. Okay, now back to the map for just a moment. There is one additional aspect of the Phoenicians to keep in view as regarding prophetic antitypes. There were two dominant city-states among these peoples, being Tyre and Sidon. The prophets treat them both with considerable scorn as concerning their base idolatry. Be that as it may, the hand of deity has nevertheless separated the prophetic antitype of each to suit his purpose. The antitype of Jezebel we have discussed. The Tyrians, however, were also great merchants of the earth, being of the same Phoenician stock. Let us now briefly explore their background and prophetic type as related to and also as distinct from the Sidonians. Tyre, as we remember, is where David and Solomon secured artisans for stonework, metallurgy, and a continual supply of cedar for the construction of Solomon's temple, as we call it. The geography of the land is highlighted in the east by the mountains of Lebanon, with their extensive forested lands that supplied timber for shipbuilding, and in the west by port cities, by which the Phoenicians became the great merchants of the seas. When Rome was still a tiny village, Phoenician traders were sailing their decked ships around the Mediterranean and beyond in search of goods for sale and trade. Among their most notable exports was the dye known as Tyrian purple, glass manufacture, ivory, and tin. In their early history, the Phoenicians traded with city-states bordering the Mediterranean Sea, and as the map that I would like to get a copy of from Uncle Richard shows, that that sea is the Sea of Tarshish. However, by 1200 BC, they are thought to have reached the Cassiterides, or Tin Isles of England, where tin was obtained for the manufacture of bronze metalworks, chiefly by the Greeks and later the Romans. To advance their positions as masters of the seas, the Phoenicians also established colonies around the Mediterranean, including Carthage, the route to West Africa, Tarshish, and lesser ports that served as terminals for shipping of wares from around the known world. Hence, the ships of Tarshish, of biblical and historical renown. In distinction from the city of Sidon and its notorious queen, the deity has chosen Tyre to be a protectorate for his people in the same manner as he anointed Cyrus to be his anointed servant for the restoration of the Jews to Zion. This decision by deity was not made due to any particular virtue of the Tyrians, but was set in order through the principle of election as he purposes to bring his plan to fruition. And this is not anything new as concerning what we've been studying this week collectively, but we'll just reinforce this. The basis for this assertion is found upon the testimony of the prophets Ezekiel and Isaiah. In Ezekiel chapter 28, a prophecy is given concerning the destruction of the prince of Tyre because of his haughty estimation of himself. Ezekiel records, "Thou hast been in the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering," pointing out that Tyre was callous to the fact that she was the anointed protectorate of Israel, or cherub that covereth, as with wings spread out over the land during the years of Jewish exile. And Brother Thomas records this: "The Eternal Spirit created and rode the Tyrian power as in a chariot, and developed it as an element of that system of powers whose relation to Israel in the days of Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and Daniel were allegorical of the powers that be in their relations to the Hebrew nation when the Russian Nebuchadnezzar shall make war upon the Anglo-Syrian," and we would also describe that as Tarshish, i.e. Tyrian, "protector of the Jews in the holy mountain of the Elohim, and cast out in the epoch of their like apocalypse of the Ancient of Days and his company of glorified myriads." We'll touch on that other reference later, Psalm 45:12 and Psalm 72:10, which are very important scriptures relating to Tarshish. Isaiah confirms this divine appointment of nations in chapter 18 with reference to this latter-day protectorate of Israel as the land shadowing with wings that sendeth ambassadors by the sea and vessels of bulrushes upon the waters. And we won't read that completely, as that has already been covered this week. Well, what evidence do we have that this has any application to this day? Because there is not agreement, brothers and sisters, that this is the case, that there is any application to this day. Well, we need to be watchmen, and we need to measure what is happening today among the nations against the scriptures. Here's a map that was published in the Bible magazine this past year. And what we have is a graphic showing where Britain and the United States have military bases throughout the Middle East. And just contemplate that for a moment. You know, Turkey, Cyprus, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, Diego Garcia, Oman, Kuwait, Israel. You know, one of the largest bases being constructed is in Israel itself. Baghdad, they did not pinpoint where those were, particularly in Iraq, but they're also in Iraq. So reason that out for yourselves. You know, are we off in saying that the Tarshish power and the young lions is a protectorate or not? As such, before the present generation, the anti-typicalitarians, or ships of Tarshish, can be seen holding unchallenged sway over the waters of the Mediterranean Sea, the Persian Gulf, the Sea of Oman, and all airspace in between, whose shadowing vigil of military power in the aerial ceases not to keep a watchful eye upon Israel, causing even the Libyan monarch to fear and tremble. And all we can do is show the evidence and maintain the voice that and be watchmen that these things are so, and pray that others will have ears to hear and eyes to see. Now this is a map of events we believe shortly to transpire. And we'll explain this a little bit. Red being the movements of the king of the north, Gog, as he penetrates the land from north and south. And I believe the prophetic record confirms that this will be a two-directional approach through Turkey and Egypt and from the sea as well. And then we have shown in blue positions of the king of the south taking the defensive posture in Arabia and Edom and Moab. And then the green representing the Jews, who will either be taken captive and or flee into Egypt and Assyria, and by virtue of the Olivet earthquake in the valley that is created near Jerusalem will escape to Edom and Moab, where again the Tarshish power will be encamped. But they are only a temporary protectorate, because eventually, as is represented by the yellow lightning bolts, there will be four chariots going out from Sinai, as recorded in Zechariah, that will be dealing with these problems. And in Zechariah, we note that two chariots go forth towards the north country to quiet Yahweh's spirit there. So, you know, you spiritual detectives out there, I think we can reason out that is because the main problem here is the king of the north, or the Gogian invader that has to be dealt with. And, you know, if you want to boil that down to the, just food for thought, boil that down to the four-square encampment, I think we have Judah and Dan, or the lion and the eagle, going forth north and east to deal with that northern problem. Similarly, we have a chariot which says goes forth to the south country. So the south would be Reuben, or the man, and south I think is also indicative of favor, or the position of favor, to go to the king of the south, which will have to capitulate his power and brought into alliance with Yahweh, Christ, and the saints. That's not to say there won't be some resistance, but they will have to capitulate. And then lastly, Ephraim, which goes to and fro to the earth. And I would suggest perhaps that's an Elijah element that deals with the Ephraim or the diaspora in various stages, which are difficult to work out in a single graphic, but just things for you to contemplate. Again, while deserving scorn and judgment of Yahweh for their reckless idolatry, pride, and will worship, these powers are nevertheless, by divine appointment, made to be antagonists. And I'm speaking of the Tyrian Tarshish power. And as Uncle Richard has reiterated several times, they have no choice in the matter. Yahweh has decreed that this is such. By divine appointment, made to be an antagonist against the Russian Nebuchadnezzar. In this capacity, the Tyrians or Tarshish power will give cause to the Gogian invader and his Sidonian allies to penetrate the land along the westernmost route through Turkey and Egypt, as choreographed by all the prophets of Israel. By all the prophets of Israel. They all speak with one voice. This will be the destiny of these two opposing players in the political heavens until both are succeeded by a new king of the south, even Messiah and his holy ones, who will break in pieces and consume the Sidonian allies when joined by all the fowls that fly in the midst of heaven, coming down upon the carcass of Jezebel, and who will then require the Tyrian merchants to capitulate their power and dominions and consecrate their wealth unto Yahweh. And we'll go back to that previous slide, because I think this is an important factor. The daughter of Tyre shall be there with a gift. Even the rich among the people shall entreat thy favor. That's Psalms 45. And let's also look up Psalm 72. The kings of Tarshish and of the isles shall bring presents. The kings of Sheba and Seba shall offer gifts. Yea, all nations shall fall down before him, and all nations shall serve him. Now, I would suggest to you that this is post the Gogian destruction. So Gog has already been put down at this point in time. And we note that very obviously, who is not here? Well, we have Tarshish, the Isles, or those young lions who question Gog's intent. They are mentioned here by name. However, Gomer, Magog, Meshech, Persia, Ethiopia, or Cush, they're not here. They're not mentioned here. I think that's noteworthy that we keep that in mind as to how Yahweh will deal with those who are the enemies of Israel and those who favor her. Now we're going to wind down. Yahweh is not a respecter of persons. We must keep this in mind in looking at the prophetic picture overall, and note that while Jezebel represents sin in the flesh and the fact that the Phoenicians were idolaters, still Yahweh's invitation to life was even open to them, as it is open to all who will seek him out individually. For example, the Tyrians providing materials and labor for the construction of the temple in Jerusalem was a foreshadowing of the day when the nations will consecrate their gain unto the Lord and their substance unto the Lord of the whole earth. Elijah himself went unto the widow of Zarephath, a Phoenician woman, during a time of famine, foreshadowing the spiritual dearth in the days of Jesus when at last God would turn to the Gentiles. Arise, get thee to Zarephath, which belongeth to Zidon, and dwell there. Behold, I have commanded a widow woman there to sustain thee. 1 Kings 17:9. And in the Gospel according to Mark, this principle of Yahweh's mercy is again epitomized, where we learn that among the multitude that thronged Jesus were Phoenicians from Tyre and Sidon. These visits apparently bore fruit as Jesus later traveled to Phoenicia. Mark 7:24. And from thence he arose and went into the borders of Tyre and Sidon, and entered into an house, and would have no man know it, but he could not be hid. For a certain woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him, and came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syro-Phoenician by nation, and she besought him that he would cast forth the devil out of her daughter. But Jesus said unto her, Let the children first be filled, for it is not meet to take the children's bread and cast it to the dogs. And she answered and said unto him, Yes, Lord, yet the dogs under the table eat of the children's crumbs. And he said unto her, For this saying go thy way, the devil is gone out of thy daughter. And when she was come to her house, she found the devil gone out, and her daughter laid upon the bed. And again, departing from the coasts of Tyre and Sidon, he came into the Sea of Galilee through the midst of the coast of Decapolis. That first reference is Mark 3, and then the latter one is Mark 7. We learn about the faith of the Syrophoenician woman that not only saved her daughter, but was a foreshadowing that the Gentiles would soon reap the spiritual benefits that were cast aside by the Jewish nation. For this, Jesus derided the unbelief of Galilee with a favorable remark concerning Tyre and Sidon. And that is recorded in Matthew 11. So let's turn there. Matthew 11:22. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable for Tyre and Sidon at the day of judgment than for you. And thou, Capernaum, which art exalted unto heaven, shalt be brought down to hell. For if the mighty work which have been done in thee had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I say unto you, it shall be more tolerable in the land of Sodom in the day of judgment than for thee. At length, it is thought that an ecclesia may also have been established there, that is in Phoenicia, that was later visited by the Apostle Paul upon his third journey. And you just might note Acts 27:3, if you want to take that into consideration. The truth cannot be judged nor understood by the mere fact that those in our family or acquaintance have some greater or lesser interest in it or not. The truth must stand alone, apart from man's praise or scorn. Our part as individuals is to work out our own salvation with fear and trembling, as Yahweh, through His Son Jesus, will select His jewels, not by membership in this ecclesia or that, not by bloodline or friendships, but by individual account. If we succeed in this, then we, like Naboth, like Jesus, despite the cost, will take hold of our inheritance as Yahweh extends to us an open hand. In summary of our class, we have seen that the account of Naboth's vineyard is a stark contrast of the servants of Yahweh with the servants of sin, whether they be organized without or within the ecclesia. May we each heed the call to choose the path of our Father's inheritance, even that which will yield the peaceable fruits of righteousness unto our Lord, and meet with His approval at His return. We'd like to close by reading 2 Corinthians chapter 9. Beginning at verse 6 of 2 Corinthians chapter 9. But this I say, he which soweth sparingly shall reap also sparingly, and he which soweth bountifully shall reap also bountifully. Every man according as he purposeth in his heart, so let him give, not grudgingly or of necessity, for God loveth a cheerful giver. And God was able to make grace abound toward you, that ye always having all sufficiency in all good things may abound to every good work. As it is written, he hath dispersed abroad, he hath given to the poor, his righteousness remaineth forever. Now he that ministereth seed to the sower, both minister bread for your food, and multiply your seed sown, and increase the fruits of your righteousness, being enriched in everything to all bountifulness, which causeth through us thanksgiving to God. In verse 15, thanks be unto God for his unspeakable gift.